This program is brought to you by the Kentucky Women Writers Conference on iTunes U at the University of Kentucky in Lexington. For more information on the conference and to access our complete audio archive, visit us online at KentuckyWomenWriters.org.
Really happy to be here. This is just such a wonderful conference. It's probably the best one that I know of happening these days. And so I'm very excited to be here. And thanks to all of you for coming. Can you hear me all right, or is this too loud, or is this working? Okay. So we have three tremendously gifted women here with us today. I was going to say this evening, but it's not yet evening, is it? We have, first of all, Jennifer Chang, whose debut collection is The History of Anonymity. She's been published in the Kenyon Review, the New England Review, the New Republic, and elsewhere, and she's currently working on a PhD in English at the University of Virginia. Our second poet on the panel here is Simone Mensch, who's the author of Orange Crush and of two previous collections, The Air Lost in Breathing and Lamp Black and Ash. Simone directs the creative writing program at Lewis University in Chicago, where she teaches creative writing and film studies. And our third poet on the panel today is Patricia Smith, who is a four-time champion of the National Poetry Slam. She's the author of five books of poetry, including a most recent book called Blood Dazzler, about Hurricane Katrina, among other things, but sort of focused on that, which was a finalist for the 2008 National Book Award. She's a professor of creative writing at the City University of New York, Staten Island. So welcome to all three of you. I was just going to begin with a general question or two and then maybe ask a specific question of each of you about your most recent collections. One of the things that struck me about all three of the recent books, Patricia's book, Blood Dazzler, Orange Crush by Simone Mensch, and The History of Anonymity by Jennifer Chang, is the sort of interplay of history and the imagination in all three of them, although in very different ways. Whether it's family history or sort of autobiography, whether it's the 17th century with the Orange Girl suite and your focus on that, and in Patricia's case, a more recent history of Hurricane Katrina. And I guess this would be just a very broad question, but I'm just wondering how do you feel that treating history in poetry, what's to sort of be gained from that, or what are some of the advantages of touching on these things in poems rather than just straightforward prose narration or straightforward recording of historical events or, you know, personal history. And if we could start with, do you want to start, Simone, and then move on to the other two? That'd be okay.
Well, let me talk about why I'm interested in history and give you a little bit of background. I mean, history is such an umbrella term. My first book is very personally historically based. It's all stories, narratives, very accessible about my family and growing up in the South. It's their stories, their history. And then when I moved to my second, I was very invested. I had a trauma in my life, and in that moment I attached to a poet, a French surrealist, who had led a much more tragic life than I ever will, because he was incarcerated in the death camps during World War II, and yet he never became bitter, and in the midst of dying he maintained a beautiful optimism. And so I felt in the singular and incidents of my own life, how could I not try to create beauty? And his story was that he was released, but the circumstances were so dire that he died 2 weeks later, and he was only 44 at the time. So the second book is grounded in his history. It's dedicated to many poets and artists, but specifically him. And then finally, the book that Lisa's pinpointing, Orange Crush, I'm interested in women's place in history and how we have been buried throughout history. And so I guess my project was to unearth some of those women. And those are both historical women, as she said, from the 1600s, Orange Girls, who were, it's a figure that I came about researching, young women in the theater who sold oranges, lemons, to generate income to keep themselves alive, but often they had to sell themselves in actuality to keep themselves alive. But then it's also how history is always binding towards women, and my project was to look at women who also unraveled those binds by refusing to be silent and by becoming poets themselves. So they're cast as characters in the book as well. And so the book becomes another salutation. And we can come back. I don't want to keep talking, so we can come back to the prose. Why not prose? But I'll hand it over to Jennifer, Patricia.
Okay.
Go ahead, Patricia.
Hurricane Katrina started out as an incident of nature. And as we watched, it became this huge, incredible, horrifying human story. Those of us who teach poetry, we're always talking about, you know, best words in the best order, that you take these, you know, every word has to do its work and every word has to move the narrative forward. And when I write, it's most of the time I start out, I have to take an incident, a huge story like that, and have it make sense in my own head. And the way for me to do that is to sort of burrow down to the essence of that story and find the words that hurt. So I had this huge story, and I had to find a way to make it make sense. I wanted to have it in a manageable space in my head. So the way to do that, I thought, was poems. I mean, it's poems where I'm digging for the heart of the story and said, how does it affect me and everyone else as a human and not just to witness the news aspect of it? I did not start out to write a book. I think that's important. There was one incident that was nudging me to write about it, and it stayed on the surface in my consciousness for so long. And, you know, those of you who are poets know that if something keeps occurring to you that way, you have to write. And once I did that, I found out by some just ludicrous statements by people how much people wanted Katrina to go away, how much they wanted to file it away. They wanted to see a nice, fresh building going up. They fixated on that, what I call the false gaiety Mardi Gras immediately after Katrina, where, you know, you have pictures of people throwing beads off balconies, but one block in either direction was just still devastation, no power, nothing. And the people who chose to focus on that one, what they thought, joyful moment would allow them to say, that's right, New Orleans is okay now. You know, so they can go on and wait for the next thing. And I wanted to stay rooted and fixated in what I had found out about Katrina for as long as possible, try to make it part of every reading that I was doing and all that. But once I heard that, I said, there's a lot of things I internalized that I didn't realize at first, not just that story, but so many stories were coming so quickly. And it was just tragedy piled upon tragedy, and no names, no faces, just this happened. Oh, wait a minute, this happened, this, you know. And I wanted to slow that all down. So my hope is that 10 years from now, you know, somebody will pick up the book in a remainder bin and turn it around to see what it's about and say, that's right, Katrina happened. And maybe they won't buy the book. Odds are they won't. They might not even open it. But unfortunately, at some point, that's all you can hope for, is just to nudge people back toward that consciousness and see if it leads them to any action. So,
I would say my work is interested in history, but the history in my work is largely imaginary and informed by the personal. And part of the reason for that is that I'm really interested in history as a concept because the history that we receive is suspect, and it's really contingent on who's telling that history. So I'm interested in the process of history making, in what it means to share a history, what histories are left out. I think a lot of that's what Patricia and Simone are talking about, recovering histories, and using the idea of history as both a composition and a thought process. I was really thinking today, too, as I was leaving my really fabulous workshop, I had just taught a class to a former student of Alan Tate's in the Robert Penn Warren room. And it just struck me as like, wow, I am an Asian American woman from New Jersey in the South sharing poetry with people. And what we're doing, too, in a lot of ways, is how do you challenge history in a way that's effective, but also challenging to aesthetic practice?
Mm-hmm. Great, great answers. This is just sort of a side a side question that goes along with that. But I'm also interested in your, well, I guess particularly in the case of Simone and Patricia's work, you're working with facts, with particular stories, from history. And so, you know, the question comes up, at least in practice for writers, I think, and for poets in particular, is, you know, do you do research? Like, what kind of role does that play, that kind of fact-finding and working with facts as you're building a poem? Because in some ways it seems like those are antithetical things. There's this idea of the poem being this intuitive thing that just kind of emerges. And so I was hoping that maybe you'd be willing to talk just a little bit about that process of combining this more factual information with these these wonderful imaginative creations that you've made. Yeah.
Well, you know, I think we're actually set up in a nice row, because I think, you know, Patricia's dealing with a crisis that is now, and mine is a history, but it was a buried history. And in fact, I did do a lot of research, and I only found two sources for this concept of the orange girl. And how I unearthed her is sort of going to the Oxford English Dictionary and sort of looking at these quotes from random writers and sort of unburying her. But for me, history, I have chaotic thoughts. So when I write, I need scaffolding. And it's the same way I teach. I give a lot of exercises. I like thematic things because I need something to rein myself in. And so having a theme and having a historical rhetorical device, which was this orange girl, became a wonderful platform to talk about all the ways in which both the women in my life and the media that I inherit, right, uses women as sex symbols, as dead girls. They are constantly, I went to the Gypsy Slam, and every woman there in some ways addressed these same topics. And one of the women, you know, really spoke to her cuteness and how she is dismissed as a woman because she's short and blonde and cute. And all of the women there were dealing with the complications of what it means to be a woman and how our own histories are challenged. So it's up to us to, you know, change our status in history as the victimized to become the victor. And we're at a wonderful point in history where, you know, we are. And so mine is more loose history, I mm-hmm. guess, though it's based on a factual figure.
It was very important to me, this is going to sound funny at first, not to do research, which would put me in another realm, put me and my book in another realm when you picked it up. I wanted to experience Katrina the same way everyone else did. Television, newspapers, magazines, whatever. There are writers that I know from the Gulf region, and I knew immediately that there was no way I could co-opt their experience. There would be nothing like being there when the rain started to fall and the wind started to blow. So no amount of research could put me in that space. I wanted people who were trying to make sense of Katrina realize that I'm doing the same thing, but I'm doing it in a way that this is how I speak to myself. This is my poetry, so this is how I'm going to do it. And I wanted you to see moments that you recognized and ideas that you recognized and questions that you too had. The only difference was at the time my husband had not yet retired, and he was an editor for Associated Press. And he would come home every once in a while and talk about what his reporters were doing in New Orleans, what they were encountering, what it was like when they were traveling with some of the New Orleans policemen. He would bring home pictures that they couldn't run in the paper, usually because they were too graphic, for any number of reasons, but usually because they were too graphic, which gave me other avenues to travel as I was writing. I was concerned, very concerned at the beginning, I knew that it was going to become a book. I was really concerned about someone from the region who, and you know, if you know anyone from the Gulf region, it's not just this is my regional location, but this is my cultural route as well. I was really concerned about people saying, "How dare you?" You know, I don't know if that's happening behind the scenes, but it didn't really happen, you know. And I'm really clear on saying I am not trying to become, a resident. I'm not trying to say I know exactly how you feel, but there were thousands and thousands of people who were kind of forced to negotiate this horrible terrain in front of their television sets, you know, and I was one of them. So that's the research that I did, you know, and I think if anybody wants to know, that there are much better books about being in the center of the storm where I was not and could never be. So it was, and also I'm used to looking for unexpected entry points into poems so that I wasn't simply a witness. I mean, for instance, Katrina is personified in the book, and beginning with that idea is what is this weather, you know, thinking as, you know, she grows stronger and she approaches land, and the first time, you know, someone dies because of her, and it turns arrogant and remorseful and laughing and vengeful and vindictive and like a woman. You know, so when I started with that, that gave me other avenues into some of the stories that could just be plain witnessing stories. They became something else because I thought I need to make this story, which has become this one thing in everyone's head. You either hated it, you were tired of it, but hopefully give you a fresh way of looking at it that would make you examine the whole event again.
Great. Maybe this question can just be addressed to Jennifer. It seems like in this debut collection of yours that you just talked about how history is very elusive, and it sort of misrepresents things in some ways, that is coded or recorded history. And I've noticed in reading over some of the poems in the book that this... this concern or this interest in the kind of slippage of facts and of truths, and whether it's different perspectives of people from the same family or something like that, that it's just so hard. Everybody has kind of their own version of things, and that seems like a prominent theme and something that you're exploring. I wondered if it was clear to you sort of before you began working on some of those poems that deal with family history, that this is what it was going to be like, or if you knew in advance that, you know, you were going to be talking about how this person sees it this way and this person sees it that way, and we have different words for things, and if that slippage of, you know, that fidelity to the fact of how things were, if that was always kind of preeminent for you in conceptualizing this collection?
That's a good question. I don't
know. Is that
know.
Too hard?
No, I mean, I like hard questions, but I think that, well, first of all, I had no idea what I was doing when I was writing any of these poems.
Okay.
To be perfectly honest. And it started out as just And both Patricia's and Simone's responses really struck me because, on the one hand, there's a responsibility to be accurate to your perspective, and then there's also the sense of you recognize repetitions. Mm-hmm. So I began a lot of these poems as a reader, and I've been reading a lot of poems. I've been reading Grimm's fairy tales. Mm-hmm. I've been reading psychological criticisms of the fairy tales. I was reading, Anne Carson, Jerry Graham, all these people, and I was recognizing repetitions that had nothing to do with me initially. And I just began writing, and the characters in the poems began to resemble characters in my life. And then I felt uncomfortable. And because I was doubting my perspective, and I think that's part of the responsibility of history. Like, how can you really be true to whatever the narrative, the story you're telling is, when you're not necessarily the best observer and you're not seeing everything? And I'm always aware that what I see isn't always accurate. I have bad eyesight. I have biases. I'm informed constantly by my own experiences. So how do I know what I'm looking at? And I think that's probably true for anything we witness, either it's in the media or in our own lives. So I think I proceeded the poems in that method. I was again thinking about process and questioning the process and questioning not just the observations I was making, but also the language I was using, which I think is really important and an important part. If you want to think about historical research, every word you use mm-hmm. is its own history.
Mm-hmm. That's a great answer. So this I think is a kind of a good segue into something that I'm also very interested in as a teacher of writing and as a writer, and that is how we make our poems, how we shape them, how we know how to put them together. And maybe again, just starting with Jennifer, in particular, it seems like just what you were talking about. I mean, I'm wondering, with some of the poems, there's this really fascinating combination of, some factual details, and then or what seem to be particular details, and then maybe a snippet of a fairy tale that's an allusion that the reader might recognize, or a myth of some kind, and then wonderful metaphors that you're just coming up with, I'm assuming. I guess in those, the poems in which you have that kind of fluid blend of things floating up and sinking down and then reappearing, with the poems that are written like that, is that something that you had that emerged as you were writing, or was it something that you thought about in advance and kind of planned to do? Again, that's a hard question, I know, yeah. But did you have thoughts of maybe having some of the drop lines and fragments and pieces of things floating around on the page that kind of correlated with what you were talking about? Or did that just emerge as you were writing?
I mean, a lot of it emerged as I was writing mm-hmm. it. And I would return to certain images because I wasn't sure about them, or they were just so iconic or archetypal to me. And the reason I was drawn to fairy tales in the first place was because they were archetypal and translatable. And I think I was figuring out what are the different ways a particular metaphor, the metaphor of the door, recurs throughout the book, and that was something I was trying to figure out. Well, why does the door keep returning? And I think just that part of what I was doing as I was writing the book was I was learning who I was as a writer, and like why I'm trying to figure out what my language was exactly.
Was water? Water figures so prominently. I mean, I kind of kept. And in one of your poems, you say I was more river, and mm-hmm. the speaker says that. And I wondered if there were any sense of that as a sort of a watery flow to the voice in some of the poems.
Yeah, I'm obsessed with water. part of it is because I was born and raised in New Jersey, but my parents were against the ocean, so I did not see the shore until I was about 12, and that's because my friend Elizabeth Parvin's mom took us. And since then, I've always lived near water. I live by river now. I live by river in New Jersey, Jersey City. It's just something that it's just always captivated me because It's also the one place where I feel graceful. Most of the time, I'm just stumbling and tripping all the time. But when I'm swimming, I can't fall. So, obsession.
Okay. So for Simone and Patricia, I just, in reading over these three collections, I was really struck with the variety of shapes to the different poems. And again, just interested in the craft of making poems. All three of you are at a point in your writing lives where you really know what exactly, it seems to me anyway, that you really know exactly what you're doing. And there, you have ideas about, well, okay. But you seem to know really how to break your lines, how to form your stanzas, and that you have ideas about how to do that. Would it be too much to ask just for you to talk a little bit about how you make the choice of how you're going to shape a poem?
Well, if you write long enough, it becomes like muscular memory. And I think when Patricia read the other night, she made a comment that the form came to her, that it came to the poem. There was no other form. I'm paraphrasing, and she can follow up. But that the poem wouldn't fit in any other form. And I believe it was her fabulous double Sestina. For me, I want to go back to language because language becomes the ladder that I often use. And I'm going to quote a friend of mine because I think, and I hope that this gets at what all three of us are trying to do, and I imagine that a lot of the women in the audience are trying to do as well. He is a writer. He's very interested in Native American studies. But he says, but the language that has been used to erase women from any meaningful record is, after all, the language that poetry can refute, rebut, and rename. And so when you ask me why not prose narratives, you know, in part, I think there's a flexibility to poetry. It provides another lens through which to look at history. Yes, there are going to be factual books about Katrina, but Patricia's book provides a beautiful and disturbing other lens in which to look at Katrina. Language itself informs all of my work. Everyone has an aesthetic. If you like Merwin, whom I love, you know that most of his language is very simple. Rain, tree, cabin. I love Stevens, and so I like the Baroque. I like the ornate. For me, poetry is about the discovery of language. And so I'm interested in diction, and I like this idea of sort of the possibilities of language. And so in that way, I let that often shape a poem. I'm also interested in form because this goes back to containers and needing to really, you know, I look at thoughts as once you put the boiler lid on, it has much more energy and explosive power. And so I often work in form. But forms, after a while, get monotonous. So the sonnet, after many hundred years, if you're doing it like Shakespeare or Petrarch, it can be boring because it's been done for 500 years. So that doesn't mean, though, the sonnet isn't a fabulous container. So what do you do with it? You update it. One of my favorite sonnet writers right now is Karen Volkman, who just put out an entire book of sonnets. And then I like to look for new forms and create forms. So this is something I have my students do. We as a group create stipulations for a form and agree as a group. So we'll have seven stipulations. It's going to be in tercets. It's going to be persona. You can't use any articles. You have to use a phrase from another poet. These are all examples. And we create our own containers. And so in that way, yes, I'm heavily invested in form, but not just traditional forms, newly invented forms as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. I was thinking of writing something.
I got introduced to poetry by getting up on stage and doing it. I hadn't studied it. I hadn't sat in the classroom and had people talk to me about, you know, voice and rhythm and meter and things like that. So right away, the most important thing was how the words sounded on the open air. That was it. You know, you had 3 minutes to get your story across. And it wasn't, contrary to popular belief, it wasn't like we were just getting up there shouting at people. I mean, there were people who gave real thought to, I'm a storyteller, I have 3 minutes, it's got to sound good, I need to get all the details in, it's got to be lyrical, it's all that stuff's going on in your head while you're writing and also while you're up on stage. And if you had looked at a piece of paper that I was reading from back in those days, it would look like a big block of prose. You know, I wasn't worried about line breaks. My line breaks were, basically where I took a breath, which when people said, can I see that poem, I would just hurriedly write it over and I'd breath, okay, I would hit some kind of line break, would wind up there. However, when I write, I talk out loud all the time. So I might say the first line over and over until the next line comes, and then I say those two lines over and over to the third line comes. And so by the end, not only does the poem sound the way I want it to sound, but I've internalized most of it. So I can talk to you about it. You know, I can talk it to you instead of, sitting there doing this. At some point, that wasn't enough. We've been talking a lot about people who begin in performance moving on and how some of them never do move on. But when you do, what's your next step? Well, I wanted to learn what the muscle and bone of the poem was. I wanted to know, I found out, which is really a liberating thing, that I had been doing things technically that I had no name for simply because I liked the way they sounded. So I found out that they were called things, and there were other ways to heighten the impact of a poem and have it be kind of in the poem's undercurrent, so it's not overwhelming, but it's there. So then I started to learn as much as I could, and the way I thought of it, it was like plumping up my toolbox so that if I have a poem that I'm a little restless about and I don't know what the problem is, it could be because it's asking for something I don't yet know how to do. So my solution for that was to make my toolbox as plump as possible so that I'm doing, for instance, a sestina in the voice of an elderly woman. Well, you know how elderly people tend to circle back around on the same words all the time. They have comfortable places in their conversations. They come back and back. So a sestina was perfect for that. Because of that sense of repetition, so at first when you learn a form, you tend to want to write in it all the time. And you get up and say, this is a, because you want everybody to know, and you pound those words, this is my rhymes word, do you hear them, because you have this real sense of accomplishment that you've gotten this technical thing over. But those edges, that smooths out, and then you realize that I now have given myself a little bit more power as a poet. And what Simone was saying, the reason I was smiling toward the end of her statement was when she's talking about inventive forms, where you reach a point where you don't just limit yourself. I mean, learning the rules in order to break them was part of what she was talking about. The sonnets, I love sonnets, but I love trying to figure out how can I still have this be a sonnet and really stamp my signature on it. And I think that's where you want to be as an artist. You want to have that traditional knowledge, but you want to just make it yours as much as you can. And I'm writing this book that has a lot of Motown in it now, so it's just all this heavy musical element. Music, music, music. So it's writing this thing about Stevie Wonder is fascinating to me. And at one point, and not a lot of people remember this, some doctors had come to Stevie Wonder and said, we think we can make you see again. And they were talking about this experimental surgery. And you heard it, and Stevie was going on shows, and he was talking about it. Then it just went away. Didn't hear anything else about it, so I looked it up. And they met with him and said, you're not a candidate for this. Mm. And so I was writing about that. And at the time, I was thinking about Sistine, I was writing it. And there was something about him and so that I wanted to change it to reflect him in a way and what he had access to, and then they had the access taken away. So I just kind of developed this other form. So you take what your story is and you let the story tell you how it wants to sound and how it wants to look. You give it that power, and then you have to make sure that you have the ability to serve the piece that you just wrote. And to have it be all that it can be, but yeah, it's a really exciting place to be. I had students and I was trying to teach them form, and I had all this, just the basics, first form, basic meters, and they shut down, boom, I don't know what it was. It's like we were beating iambic pentameter into the walls. We were stomping. We were, you know. And sometimes you just, you don't hear it. And for people not to hear iambic drove me crazy, but they just didn't hear it. I had to change everything that I was doing. So we have to be receptive to that tradition in order to make it non-traditional.
I really like that. I think all writing is a constant struggle between form and content. I think all writing is a constant struggle between form and content. And I think that's what Patricia and Simone are speaking to. For me, it is. I'll break it down into two parts then. In terms of the content, whatever I'm writing, it begins as a process of inquiry. I don't know. I'm in a place of unknowing. And only language can get me to a place of knowing. So that's the content. In terms of form, on the other hand, you have to decide what kind of shape it's going to be. Form is very important, and I used to work in form a lot more, but now it seems like it's like the practicing room. You know, that's where I do my scales. That's where I remember, my muscle memory, as Simone says. But it's also something that I have to constantly reinvent and resist and rebel against. So if I'm doing a lot of drop lines, I have to stop. And before it becomes a habit, a bad habit or a manner, I have to decide that this is what is essential to the content, to the process of inquiry. And I've gone through phases where I will just write couplets until it kills me, just to figure out what is a couplet, what is a quatrain, and what is it, not just what is it. You know, we know what it is in terms of definition, but what is it to me as a poet? I think the sonnet's a great example, and I'm thinking about Claude McKay and County Cullen, who are two poets from the Harlem Renaissance who wrote amazing sonnets. And they're not love sonnets. They're sonnets. They turn the sonnet into a revolution because they're nodding to the history of the sonnet, but also reinventing it. And that's basically what I want to do. I want to reinvent the forms that I'm using so that they're essential to the content, but also become new as a poem, as poems for me, and also true to the inquiry that I'm trying to figure out.
Well, we've heard a little bit about Patricia, the project that you're working on now, but I'd love to hear Simone and Jennifer talk about maybe some of the things that you're interested in right now, or the topic maybe that's obsessing you, or do you have a particular project that you're working on at the moment?
I have several, and I want to quickly go back to the form. You know, I swore that I would never say never, right, the whole cliche, but I swore that I would never write a prose poem, because though I love prose poems, I love the line more. Well, sure enough, in my Orange Crush book, there's a whole series of prose poems, and I didn't find that form. The form found those poems, and ultimately it was the only form those poems could go into, because they were dedicatory poems to women poets whose language I was using, and so I needed to create these expressionistic paintings, and I wanted them to visually be blocks, so they represented that. In terms of current projects, you know, for me writing, if you look over the course of my books, everyone's completely different. If you don't like Orange Crush, you would probably love my first book. If you love my first book, you probably won't like my second book as much. Some poets don't write that way, but for me, I'm always learning, and I always want to keep changing. So my new two projects, I got tired of being a singular poet and being solipsistic and of my own cruelties and jealousies and solipsism. So I collaborated, and my fourth book coming out the end of this year is a purely collaborative project. It's written with a male poet who's also a musician, and we started. Gina, are you in the room? She's not here. In Portland. He lived in Portland. I live in Chicago. We weren't dating. This wasn't a romantic collaboration. It was a respectful of one another's art collaboration, and we had similar political ideologies, so a lot of the poems are political. And then my new project, which I'm really excited about, and my students here, I hope, are equally as excited about today, is writing centos, going back to form. Mm-hmm. I am in love with a cento, which is a patchwork form. It's basically collage, and it's a collage form in which you graft other poets' lines together to form a new piece of art. And so I have an entire chapbook, and it started out as one poem, became a chapbook, and now it's definitely going to be a book. Whether it'll be published or not, who knows? But I will say that editors certainly haven't shied away from publishing them. They may as a book, because you do get into questions of fair use. But in terms of individual poems, there have been no problems. And it's, for me, I love it because for me, writing is reading. And so it really makes me fully investigate other people's work, because you can't write centos without immersing yourself in other writers.
I wouldn't say I have a set project. I often write until the project finds me. And in the last 2 or 3 years, I found I kept writing poems about strangers. There was just a character named a stranger, or you who was undefinable. And part of it was I was interested in complicating what a you could be, more than a beloved, more than God, but just an other, someone else who is somehow attempting intimacy or challenging intimacy. But since then, I've been branching out, and like, I think my interest in writing towards a you is also an interest in writing with a stronger sense of community and a stronger sense of audience, because I too worry about the solipsism of poetry, especially lyric poetry. I don't want to just write sad poems about how sad I am, and I think that's another thing that I have been thinking about, because I'm not a sad person, and I can be funny and amusing and fun to be around, and I've been sort of challenging that and like trying to figure out new ways into the lyric that open up the language without and make the language difficult without making it inaccessible. A lot of the poems in the History of Anonymity are towards a long poem, so I've also been working on shorter lyrics. So mostly, it is mostly like a formal quest right now, and my main obsession is to finish my dissertation. So.
Because Blood Dazzler is in a week or two, week and a half, is debuting as a dance theater production in New York. Oh. And so I've been working with these dancers, and actually the whole process started at the Kentucky Women's Writings Festival 5 years ago, when Urban Bush Women danced here, and one of the choreographers came to my reading later and heard one of the poems, and got in contact with me later and said that she saw movement, and did she mind if I gave her a poem, a copy, and gave it to her, and she choreographed a dance. And when I wrote more poems, she asked for them until she had the whole book, and now we have we're working on it for about 3 years. So that kind of opened up my mind so much to collaboration that the pieces I'm writing now, she's waiting for me to finish the book so I can give her the book and we can write a script and sort of market it both ways. So I love, you know, we talk about collaboration. I've always collaborated with musicians and, you know, blues artists and anything. I mean, it gives you another way of looking at your work, mm-hmm. through somebody else's eyes, which is really energizing. The other thing, when I'm done with this, my husband, who retired from the newspaper and then wrote a crime novel, and as a poet, you know, we get so few accolades. My husband writes this novel. He sweats through it. He smokes those damn nasty cigars all day. The book gets done. His book was then named one of the top 10 debut fiction of any kind, any genre, 2010. He got his Kirkus Review, his Booklist Review, and his Library Journal Review. He has blurbs from like 12 people, including like Michael Connelly, Dennis Lehane, you know, and I'm like, huh? And I'm watching this, and you know, we have an office where we're like side by side, so I'm watching this, and he said, oh, guess what just came in today? And I go, that's really, I got my little poem here, you know. But what we just recently decided to do, I'm originally from Chicago, and 1968 was a really formative year in Chicago. It's the year of the, you know, the riots and, you know, everything that was going on nationally, SDS and all that. And I grew up on the west side, where it's a part of town they tell you to stay away from. And I always been fascinated that women used to do hair out of the back of their houses. You know, just open up the back door and there was a chair there and you were ready for your hair. You came, you sat, they did, the stove was right there. They put the hot comb on the stove, they did your hair, you know. And it was back when the police still walked beats, you know, and so there'd be these cops, and you're the quintessential Chicago cops are always kind of big, white, and beefy, and they're walking around, you know. And I thought, wouldn't it be really interesting if there was like a romance? You know, because the cop would stop in these places and check with the women, everything okay? And the women, if there was a romance blossoming between this big white Irish cop and this little, you know, this black woman who did hair out of her back door, that they found themselves being a little bit more attracted to each other, and everybody went, oh my God, oh yeah. So what we decided to do, this is my next project, is it's going to be, I don't know if I've called it a novel, I don't know what we're going to call it, but we're going to write in alternating voices, because he's used to that kind of terse, you know, chopped crime voice, you know, where he doesn't put in a lot of detail, which I think the cop would sound like that, and I'm going to write the voice, and so it'll be them like this, alternating back and forth through this, going towards this relationship, and the riots are going to be in the middle of that and all that. So I don't know how that's going to come out. I don't know if I still be married when it's over. We work really well together now, you know, but I'm not quite sure. So that's something we're just starting to work on.
Yeah, I want to say, well, I just think that sounds like a fabulous concept. But collaborative work, if any of you do it, you know, you can do it with artists, you can do it with musicians, other writers. Sometimes it works beautifully, and sometimes it's a complete disaster. And I've worked with 4 other writers, and I would say most of those are successes, but only one did we create a book. And one person was such a disaster that I had probably 25 pages of text that I just threw out, and I never throw anything out. So it's you have to find the right fit with collab.
And if you're collaborating with someone if they're not writers. My first instinct with dancers, the first time I went backstage and one of the dancers was on the phone and she had her foot on her head and she was like, oh, love, you know. It's like, what? So they're doing something like really huge. That they have a technical skill you don't have. So your instinct is to say, here, take my poems, make magic, you know, and let them do whatever. And even as you see your vision getting farther and farther away, you're surrendering to their skill and saying, well, they must know what they're doing. And so you have to be sure that they know that it's a true collaboration. You will not be doing this without me knowing, and I won't change anything without you. And that's really hard when your skills are so different. Mm-hmm. So you have to kind of really stand your ground and go, those are my words, that's not what I see. Or I see this and you're not doing it. Okay, so it could get a little prickly, but you need to be centered in the whole process and not be taken away by it.
Well, we have a few minutes left. I actually just wanted to open up the discussion and see if those of you who are listening to all of this fascinating material have questions for the three poets. And let you all turn the discussion to what might interest you.
Sort of all three of you can jump in. Do you think, I write short stories and wrote a memoir novel, and I'm wondering, and that sort of comes out of me naturally, like nonfiction short stories and stuff, but do you think that a poet is different than another writer? Like, is that just what you, or do you all write fiction and nonfiction too? I'm just wondering, like, if you think that it's almost like a different animal of a person that then becomes a poet, because it's like a, one thing that doesn't seem natural to me.
I don't think so. I started out as a fiction writer, and I still occasionally write fiction. But I think it's also, for me, it goes to the form and content question, because there are just questions I have that poems can't answer, and that's one reason why I write essays and why I went back to academia. I would like to write more fiction, and I hope that we're not so unique that we have to be poets. I mean,
I ditto. Jennifer just put that beautifully. But you know, I prefer. I'm more adept at writing poetry. I've written fiction. I suck. But that doesn't mean I couldn't learn it. And in actuality, I teach it, and I love teaching it. So I'm teaching a class. You know, topics in writing, writing fiction and studying fiction. But so I think it, as she said, it's where your, what your language finds a home in. I do think that actually knowing poetry, you know, becomes a nice basis for writing fiction. And then creative nonfiction is another animal, but I think they're definitely sutures between the three genres. And if you can do one well, it doesn't mean you can do another well, but it definitely means you have the potential to learn, because in effect, you have the tool of language.
I go into a lot of schools, and you go into like a 6th, 7th grade classroom, and you say, I'm here to teach you poetry, and right away they go, I can't do that, but I can do this. My teacher says, I'm really good at writing this way, or I'm good at math, but not at, you know, so it made me think how early we're asked to categorize ourselves and declare, represent, what are you going to do? What kind of writing are you going to do? And so I spend a lot of time trying to blur those lines that we've drawn between the genres. And I think we all have to tell ourselves we're storytellers first and foremost. What the mode we choose to tell the story is of the least importance. You know, you may meander back toward poetry more than you do short stories or whatever. But poems are kind of snapshots in a continuing narrative. So this story is going, and you say, oh, that's interesting. Poem. That's good, too. Poem. So then you got a poem in front of you, and I tell students that poem came from somewhere and it's going somewhere. So let's take it and stretch it out and broaden those characters and that moment and what happened before that and what happened after. And before you know it, they have a short story. You know, and then with a little technical knowledge, you can change that short story into a scene in a play. So if I'm teaching kids to do this, who am I to just say, you know, I'm a poet and nothing else? I mean, we all have this story that's pushing at us. So a poem is just like this little thing where you throw it in water and it grows. You know, it's like having all the story in a little space you can take and you can hold it, and, you know. But the whole story is still there, and there's no reason you can't. You know, that you can't go elsewhere with it. You know, so I like poems because they're huge stories in small spaces, but I also like it because the whole story is always right there and you have access to it and you can move in other directions and do other things with it.
I'll also add that when I wrote my first poems as a little girl, I had no idea they were poems. And again, like someone had to come tell me, these are poems. So genre is really about reader expectation and desire. But to that extent, I think it's really important for all writers to study all the different kinds of crafts it takes to write in these different forms. Mm-hmm. Because reading novels teaches me a lot about sustaining attention in a longer poem or how to thread a narrative through an entire manuscript.
Also, writer's block. People are just talking about, blocked, how do I do? You know, try thinking of yourself, you know, take the story, the poem or whatever that's driving you nuts, and start to write it as a children's story. You know, turn it into a larger story. You know, I mean, sometimes just getting yourself out of that little space that you've drawn for yourself. You know, you've drawn a little cage around and there's walls everywhere. And sometimes just thinking of it in another way as appealing to not the target group you're writing for, but maybe another group. You know, sometimes turn it to something totally silly and start using, you know, nonsense language and make it a children's story. You know, and who knows, you might even wind up with a good children's story. You know, but just don't
don't draw that tight little space for yourself that you can't get out of, you know, start thinking of your work in one way all the time. And one more thing, I'm sorry. The whole and while I'm talking about that writer's block thing, it really does help to be writing something in more than one genre at once. So if the poem stops, then and you change scenes, change locale, change people, and go over to a short story you're fiddling with. You don't have to be good at short stories. You don't have to know all the technical aspects. You know, just something else over here that as a writer you're curious about and you're trying to make work. And you pulled yourself out of this pressurized place into this light place where you don't have those kind of expectations for yourself. And if you've got two of those on the burner, then, you know, sometimes that's all you need. So you're still writing, so you don't feel guilty, but you're not blocked.
And I want to add an anecdote to both of their responses. You know, I think it's a problem of labeling. We are so often labeled. You're a woman, you're a man, you're white, you're black, you're gay, you're heterosexual. You're slam, you're page. We label ourselves, and we can't think beyond that box. And I had a woman come the other day. She's not here. She came to my poetry class as a journalist, and she had to write a poem, and she didn't want to read it. And being the taskmaster I am, I forced her to, and it was a fabulous poem. And, you know, Lisa is here and a few of my students that were there. It was just, it was lovely. And she didn't trust in that because she had already considered herself not a poet. So I think it's just, you know, learning how to unlabel yourself.
How does that work for you?
I keep a journal, but it's because no one listens to me. No, I mean, I keep a journal, and it used to be more useful for mining for material, but now it's like I'm just stretching. I just need to release language before I actually write, or if I just need to make a mess, that's what my journal's for.
I don't keep one. I tried, and then I found myself going back to it and twiddling with it like it was a poem. Mm. So I just stopped and said I should be writing poems instead. So I never kept one with any regularity.
Same here. I do, I guess you could call it a journal, but I don't. I like to write at night as I'm slipping into unconsciousness because my editor leaves, or a glass of wine helps. But that space when you're not judging yourself, and so I write on my computer in bed, and then I save it, and I just have this whole document, nighttime writings, and then several months will go by, and I'll have time to sit in that space and read it. And it's amazing the motifs and patterns that your brain creates. And so I go back, and then, you know, it's as though you're a sculptor, you know, you're chipping away at this larger thing and seeing something in that. And so in that way it's a journal, but it's not a personal journal. It's my nighttime writings.
There's somebody back there.
I know Jennifer spoke a little bit about this earlier, but last few days, I heard a lot of people talking about, you know, my next project when I was writing the book. And I guess, you know, I can't picture that in my mind, you know, I'm writing what's coming out. And I know you spoke a little bit about your writing being inquiry and you're looking, you know, then you see patterns. But maybe y'all can talk a little bit about, are you always kind of looking, writing toward a project, or are you just finding the project in what's coming out of you?
With the first couple of books, there was no project. It was just kind of this purging. You know, one thing didn't necessarily lead to another, and those are the things we come to call our collected. but yeah, there were different topics. It was kind of all over the place, and I think we all kind of have to go through that because all of a sudden we've got this second throat that we didn't know we had. And it's like, all these stories, things come back from your past, and something happened to me yesterday, and I heard something on the bus, and you know. But I think that's a honing process, too, even though it's not really that evident, you know, that we're we're making choices about what's important to us, the people who are important to us, the movements in our head, you know. And as we do that, we tend to give more attention to the themed things. Well, it looks like family keeps coming up. And you might not see, you know, and I know that, you know, when I lost my father, that was behind everything, whether I was actually saying that in my poems or not. So everything made my voice a little bit stronger and made me comfortable at confronting things that were harder for me. And that's where the themes began to emerge. So I think at first we really are. And there's a tendency now, you look at a lot of books are on things. Now people discover characters in the news. They go back and they're, you know, things you discover on the way to looking up other things. You know, people in history that you didn't know about, you know. A friend that I worked with, a wonderful poet by the name of Tahemba Jess, who wrote a book about lead belly, and he researched. Now he's writing a book about blind singers, and he's constantly in the library, and his mind works that way. Mine doesn't, you know. So, and you see these great themed books, and then you find yourself in this weird position of looking for, you know, I'm going to find something like that too, you know, and that's kind of not where you want to be. You want it to happen kind of organically. But my first couple of books, there was no project. There wasn't anything in mind. Like, I might say my book, but that was it. The project comes when you realize that your voice parallels other artists. You know, your story parallels other people. And you start to put those together in a more cohesive manner. And that's where it comes up.
Yeah, I mean, I think if by any deception I gave you the idea that I always know what I'm writing about, let me tell you it's not true. And Jennifer made the fabulous quote that writing is a process of inquiry and that she begins from a place of unknowing. Every piece I write begins from that place. But what happens, I think, in alignment with what Patricia said, is that somewhere along the way, I start seeing the connections. So Orange Crush didn't come about me reading all these books and going, oh, I'm going to write a book about orange girls. It came about through a series of incidents. I was watching Buffy, which greatly influences my psyche. I know that sounds silly to some of you, but its ability to position woman as agent, its playfulness with language, it's actually a really thought-provoking show. And I was doing this 20 lines a day with a friend just so I would write every day, because as you know, as women, as men, our lives get consumed with labor and chores and contracts with people. So if you don't carve out a space to write, you're just not going to do it. I don't believe in writer's block, but I believe in the fact that if you don't create a block of time, then yes, that block gets eclipsed. So as I was rereading these, I noticed that I was heavily invested in the idea of the dead girl, and then the dead girl and the orange girl sort of merged with my obsessions that I've had all along, which is loss, ambiguity, themes of women's empowerment, silence. I come from a family in which I was so incredibly shy, and this is hard to believe now. None of my students believe it. But as a kid, I literally lost my voice. I would sit and pee in my pants before I would ask someone where the restroom was. And so, you know, so these are obsessions. And someone said the other day, I think it was Diane Ackerman, write to your obsessions, because your obsessions will pretty much be your obsessions your whole life. And so I guess if anything becomes a container, it's my obsessions. But I always write from a place of unknowing. The knowing comes later.
Yeah, the knowing comes later. I think for many people, the project comes later, because I think, well, it's risky to start with a project in mind, because then you're essentially creating assignments for yourself, and you don't want your poems to be assignments. You want them to be necessary, urgent, that they had to come into being. So I think the poem is the project, and the obsession will gradually emerge and identify itself. But that happened to me, too. I was so shy, I didn't talk for a year.
Yeah, I mean, I bet half the people in this room have dealt with that. And if you haven't personally, then you have a daughter or a mother or someone who has a similar response. I don't know if Lisa wants to take any more questions, but I think that Lisa Williams proposed this, and you just did such a beautiful job.
Yeah, thank you so much,
you.
Lisa.
This has been a presentation of the Kentucky Women Writers Conference and the University of Kentucky. Copyright 2010, all rights reserved.